Okay, folks, welcome to Life on Planet Porky, the latest chapter, the latest great adventure here with myself, the Porkmeister, and of course, the star of the show, who is the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. And Leslie Ann, since we last got together exchanging views over the electronic website where we meet each other at least once a week, you've been very, very busy. I'm particularly impressed that a woman like yourself, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, can at one moment be a church warden in St. Bride's, the journalist church and one that I know very well, and where you're a church warden. And then hours later, you are the rock chick writer extraordinaire and getting down and with it with the kids and all the sort of things that, you know, the rock people do. Please explain your actions.
Well, I've got to have feet in all the camps, haven't I, Mike? You know, it's the only way to stay ahead, as it were. But, you know, like you, I was a journalist for all those years. St. Bride's the spiritual home of our industry. And we have an annual service to commemorate fallen journalists every November. And it was particularly interesting this week because we had some very respected speakers, Davey, the Director General of the BBC.
Oh, yes, yes.
And also Anthony Lloyd, the great war correspondent of the Times.
Right.
Sort of reflecting on how truth is more important than ever in this age of social media and fake news, that to go to the ends of the earth in search of the truth and to report it back to people who want to hold our government accountable and want to know what's going on out there, that job actually has never been more vital than it is today.
Yeah. Well, yes and no, really. I mean, when you and I were in Fleet Street, the only way that people found out what was going on was in newspapers. That's why I was in Libya when the Americans bombed it. That's why you were in Hollywood and Los Angeles for so long, because there wasn't 24-hour television. There wasn't access to people like there is now. Can I just get back to your Fleet Street ventures and St. Bride's in particular? I don't know if you want to share this with our audience of millions, but you actually met the future Queen, didn't you, the other night?
I did. I was asked to write a report, actually, of proceedings. And so I was placed in the front pew, right up the front of the church, near to the altar. And as I took my seat, I noticed there was a cushion just beside where I was about to sit down. So I looked around.
Yeah.
There's obvious bodyguard, you know, right behind it in the row, just behind me.
Oh, really?
And I said to the person...
There's a bloke with a gun sitting behind you.
You know what bodyguards look like. I can't say whether he had a gun or not, because I didn't ask to have a look at it. But you know what a bodyguard looks like.
Sure.
They have a demeanour about
them. They look a bit like Daniel Craig, actually, don't they?
A little bit, yeah, except this guy was really big. And they have 100 eyes in their face. Their face is looking everywhere. And so I suddenly twigged, oh, no, Camilla's going to sit right here. I don't want to sit next to her. I'm not her biggest fan, I have to say. I'm one of the old school who still thinks that...
Well, that's a bit harsh. If you don't mind me interrupting there, you're not her biggest fan, but have you ever met her before, or are you just talking about things you've read in, you know, what our business is all about, newspapers?
I haven't met her before, but I do have a nagging thing inside of me that if not for Charles's continued affair with Camilla, that Diana would still be alive.
Well, I think that was Charles's decision, wasn't it, rather than Camilla's?
What do you mean?
Well, in the sense that if Charles had been a faithful husband, married to one of the most beautiful women in the world, which Diana became, and one of the most cherished women in the world, Camilla would have had no part in his life if Charles had done the proper thing and the right thing.
Well, it's not really true, is it? Because they never stopped their affair. Even though she was married to somebody else, Charles and Camilla carried on, regardless of their relationships with other people.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we can't moralise, we can't judge, we're not them, we don't really know. But I just feel that Diana's life was wasted because he was an unfaithful husband. But what do I know? So anyway, I don't really want to sit next to her.
But listen, you're so right to talk about it now, because it's now back in the news again, because Harry is now, you know, pontificating again on all sorts of things, except for the fact that he's taken £100 million off Netflix, and Jemima Khan, who was a friend of Diana's, has pulled out of any relationship with Netflix because she thinks that they abused Diana. But that's another story. Please, I want our listeners to know What happened when Camilla arrived?
So Camilla comes in, and our wonderful rector, the Reverend Canon Alison Joyce, walked her down the nave to come and sit in her seat. And by this time, I've persuaded a lovely journalist called Kate from the Mail on Sunday to sit between us.
Oh, yeah.
So Kate is actually sitting next to Camilla.
Didn't you want to sit next to the future queen?
No, I didn't, no. Really? I didn't know what to do with my hands. So
really?
So she sits there, and she was very pleasant. Mm. And in fact, she's going on tour with them, I think, mm-hmm. next week or the week after. So that was quite nice for her. But I was giving Camilla the once-over, you know,
mm-hmm.
and she wears a Fitbit.
I don't know what a Fitbit is, I'm sorry.
Yeah, you do. So, yeah, it's one of these electronic devices. You wear it on your arm, and it monitors how many steps you do.
Oh, okay, 10,000 steps a day, yeah?
Yeah, your heart rate and your pulse and all yeah. that kind of stuff, and it collects all this information. So she's got a Fitbit on. She also had one of those bits of string, you know, that is, I think, a friendship bracelet. It's like a little bit of plaited string, and it has a bead on it.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm thinking, is this
a bit like the rosary beads that people
yeah, a bit like
faith
that.
Carry? Yeah.
So, yeah, she had a little black cape on, and she had a handbag, and she tucked her glasses away in it. And so I was doing my observant bit, you know.
Yes.
But her face is a stone. It doesn't budge. She did sing the hymns, but she doesn't open her mouth very wide.
Yeah.
And I suppose all of that is to do with not being caught by a photographer in an ungainly sort of
Maybe.
Facial expression or
Maybe.
Something.
She likes a gin and tonic or two, though, doesn't she? We know
I
that.
I guess she does, but she didn't give much away.
Okay.
But she was very well behaved, as you'd expect. Mm. So I got away with it.
Mm. Yeah. Okay, that's excellent. But then you see, so there you are, churchwardens, simp brides and all that, you know, paramount of virtue, paragon of virtue, I should say.
paramount of virtue.
Yeah, paramount, yeah, well, paramount's a film company, I think, isn't it? Mm. Paragon of virtue. And then within half an hour, you're getting down with the rock and roll set at Joe Allen. You know, I mean, how do you marry these two sides of your life together, Miss Jones?
Well, aren't they all part of being human?
Don't know.
You know, there's no rule that...
Allen.
Mm. Well, there's no rule that says that a member of the clergy can't have a good stiff drink, you know.
Yeah, the stiff drink.
There's no rule.
Family show here, Miss Jones.
There's no rule that says that the degenerates in Joe Allen can't nip into a church service.
Yeah, okay.
We're all part of the same thing, aren't we, really?
Did you take the rector with you to Joe Allen?
No, I would have done, but she was tired. She had a long, long day yesterday.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I should imagine she does. Absolutely fascinating, honestly, the different avenues in your life. One of them, of course, is that you have been such a distinguished Fleet Street reporter for so long, and you're now a writer. And I was fascinated to read the obituary of a lady called Maureen Cleave. And, of course, as soon as I saw it first in the back of the Daily Telegraph, I realised that this is the woman that you've written about quite extensively in Who Killed John Lennon, your book, because it looks like she was the original reporter who sort of latched onto the Beatles very early on, discovered they were going to be huge. Gillian Reynolds was her friend at Oxford University, where they both studied, and Gillian Reynolds became another distinguished writer and journalist. And Gillian Reynolds said to Maureen Cleave, there's this group from Liverpool called the Beatles, and everybody's making a fuss about them up in the north of England where my family are. Go and have a look. Otherwise, Maureen Cleave would never have heard of them. She went up there, and the rest actually is quite historical, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose it is. She was a friend of the band, a little bit older than them, quite sophisticated, obviously very educated.
Yeah.
But they became friends. There was a rumour, went round for years, that she and John Lennon had a long-standing affair.
Yes.
Because her access to the group was extraordinary. So she would get these exclusive interviews all the time. She was writing for the Evening Standard in London at this point.
Yeah.
And she did an interview with John, which became very famous throughout the world, because during this interview, she mentioned, he mentioned, in fact, they were talking about all kinds of stuff, and they were talking about the level of fame of the Beatles.
Mm.
And in John's throwaway manner, he happened to remark that, you know, the Beatles are even bigger than Jesus, by which he meant more people in the world know about them. Not that the Beatles were more important than Christianity,
sure.
but This was never picked up on when it appeared in the Standard in the UK. The piece was repeated in an American magazine called Datebook, which was quite a radical sort of mag, which the young underground followed. And this throwaway remark of John's was blown up out of all proportion, made into a headline, and created a huge scandal to the point that radio stations across America were inciting people to riot and to bring all their Beatles records and memorabilia and T-shirts and all of that and throw them on these massive bonfires and burn them.
Yeah.
And they wanted to ban the Beatles. And of course, the Beatles were on tour in America. There were riots, Beatles Go Home, Jesus Died for You, John Lennon, all of this. Yeah. And it was sickening. The Beatles actually thought they would be assassinated by the Ku Klux Klan during that tour.
Yeah, it got very nasty. I remember seeing the pictures as a kid, you know, black and white pictures of all these, you know, people throwing Beatles LPs onto bonfires and all that. However, they somehow got over that, you know, quite very quickly, really, because I think I'm right in saying, aren't I, that John Lennon, to this day, to the day he died, was even more popular in the United States than he was in this country.
Well, they got over it. Yeah, Brian Epstein, the manager, made them give this press conference at which they had to apologise.
I remember John Lennon saying something like, I didn't say I was more popular than Jesus Christ. I didn't say I was more famous. I remember it distinctly.
Yeah, but if you look at the footage, he was almost in tears and he looks so scared.
Yeah.
But I pulled up the quote because I was interested just to see what did he actually say?
Yes.
Because we always hear this line, oh, the Beatles said, John Lennon said the Beatles are bigger than Jesus.
Yes.
What he actually said was this, Christianity will go. It will vanish and shrink. I needn't argue about that. I'm right and I will be proved right. We're more popular than Jesus now. I don't know which will go first, rock and roll or Christianity. Mm. Jesus was all right, but his disciples were thick and ordinary. Mm. It's them twisting it that ruins it for me. So, you know, not that inflammatory, is it, really? It's just his musings.
And you know, what he says about disciples, thick and ordinary and all that, what an expressive thing to say. People got to remember, John Lennon was about 24 years of age at the time, wasn't he, or 25.
Yeah.
I couldn't philosophise on life at that age. He was a very bright guy, really, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah, and of course he's reflecting on the fact that the people that Jesus called as disciples were just ordinary fishermen.
Yeah.
They weren't educated. They were just general ordinary blokes.
Yeah.
So it's the whole point about the Beatles also had that affiliation with the ordinary man in the street, with normal people.
Yeah.
They weren't courting aristocrats or much more important people the way many rock stars do today.
I know.
So it's quite a big point he was making there.
Yeah, he wasn't making incredible.
He was ahead of his time, wasn't he?
No, way ahead of his time. Listen, we're not going to go on about the Beatles or Maureen Clee forever, but I read an incredible line. She was so close to John Lennon that they're in a taxi going to a recording studio, and John Lennon had written the lyrics for the next Beatles song on the back of a birthday card somebody had sent him, okay? And she looked at them and said, the second line's not strongest. And it was this song, and I'm going to sing it for you. I find the things that you do will make me feel all right. John Lennon had written, and I feel, he'd written, when I get home, he'd written, when I get home to you, I find my tiredness is through. And Maureen Cleave changed that to, when I get home to you, I love the things that you do. And I just think that's an incredible moment in history when it happens. But anyway, look.
Quite risque lyrics, by the way.
Oh, very risque. Very risque. By the way, and we must get off the Beatles because we've got lots of other things to talk about. One of the Beatles' early song, Don't You Know What I Mean? She was only 17. Now, again,
so it wasn't quite like that, was it?
Well, the original song.
She was just 17, if you know what I mean.
Exactly.
That's the line.
Thank you very much indeed. And it was that you know what I mean, which John Lennon put into the song, knowing that every man, wink, nudge, nudge, would know what I mean. You see what I mean?
I was very fortunate to hear Paul McCartney speak about this last Friday night.
Incredible.
I went to the Royal Festival Hall I didn't have any idea that I was going. My daughter got me a ticket, and she rang up and she said, "You're going to the Royal Festival
Hall." When was this?
This was last Friday night.
My goodness me, fantastic.
And so there I am in this amazing seat, just a few rows back from where Paul McCartney is sitting on stage with Paul Muldoon, the poet, who's co-written this book, the lyrics of, you know, the one you and I spoke about on GB News.
Absolutely.
Which
incidentally, and I'm not supposed to know this, my family have bought me for Christmas, so I'm rather pleased about
it. Lovely. Oh, okay. Well, they're spot on. You will enjoy it.
Yeah.
So Paul is there, and he's talking about this very song and chuckling over the origins of it.
Really?
Because there was quite a lot of cheeky stuff between the lines of their lyrics, which was risque for the time and ahead of its time as well.
Yes. No,
I've got to say, you know, that the interviewer they used for this piece, I was very disappointed. Yeah. This BBC girl, Samira Ahmed, who made very clear that she didn't know anything about the music, knew nothing about the Beatles, wasn't really interested, didn't ask him about the lyrics. He had to keep injecting information about the lyrics himself.
Yeah.
She kept trying to steer the conversation
Did all this happen on the stage at this thing you went to?
Yeah. I wrote a long piece.
Why on earth didn't Macca invite you to be the...
I would have bitten his hand off.
I was going to say, to be the controller of that show. Because
I wrote...
you know more about his life than he does.
Well, I hope so. I wrote a blog about it, which has had a huge response because I basically said what I thought about the night. Having said that, it's never a disappointment to be in the same room as Sir Paul McCartney.
Well, absolutely.
And, you know, I always say this about Her Majesty the Queen as well. Long may they live.
Yes.
Because God knows what it's going to be like when they're gone.
No, I couldn't agree more. Right, well, that's the Beatles segment, folks. And the reason you tune into Life on Planet Porky is, A, you like to hear our Fleet Street stories and you like to hear our Beatles stories. And as Leslie Ann is one of the world's greatest experts on the Beatles, it's well worth tuning in. Let's move on to another musical family, Leslie Ann. And I can't believe that I'm so ignorant about it. Sound of Music, okay? The Sound of Music... You were too young, actually, for your mum to take you to the Odeon cinema when you were 8 or 9 years of age to watch The Sound of Music. But my mum did, and I've got two sisters. So we were literally 7, 8, 9. You know, mum took us to the Odeon cinema in Chester and bought us all an ice cream. We sat there, and she loved the film much more than we did because we were too young. But I didn't realise the Von Trapps, who were the subject of that film with Julie Andrews, were real until I read a piece in the Sunday Times colour magazine, and the oldest brother, the Von Trapp, is still around and runs a sort of facility in Vermont in the United States where they had to emigrate to escape the Nazis, called, you know, Von Trapp's The Sound of Music. And I just didn't know the Von Trapps were real. I suppose you did.
Well, actually, I did, yeah. I've known that for a long time. They were a performing family group.
Yeah.
And, of course, that story was, I think it was based on either a memoir or a book about the family. Most films are based on books, aren't they?
Sure.
And that's what they picked up on. It's a film I've seen many, many times because we all have. It's in the collective DNA, isn't it? And Julie Andrews is preserved for all time as that perfect.
Julie Andrews has only ever made two films, Sound of Music and Mary Poppins, both within 18 months of each other.
Well, what about Victor Victoria?
I can't even remember that. I don't think I've
ever seen. Dustin Hoffman was in that with her.
Was he? Well,
she was a woman who dressed as a man who played a woman who was in drag in a show or something.
Yeah. Well,
very weird. She was married to the director, Blake Edwards, at the time.
I see, yeah. Ten. He made a film called Ten, didn't he?
Bo Derek and Dudley Moore.
Exactly. Absolutely. Dudley Moore, great guy. He was in another film called Arthur, wasn't he? Where he was a duke living in America and drunk all the time. Anyway, what's...
And Sir John Gielgud was his butler, I think.
Absolutely right. Well done. You got.
And it was remade. It was remade with Russell Brand.
Really? And it was a disaster.
Was it Michael Caine played his butler in that version?
I don't know, but it was a disaster because...
It was a flop, yeah.
Yeah, he came over as being nothing like as cuddly and warm as the original Ten. No, what I was going to say about the Von Trapps was, I read the this piece in the Sun-Times Colour magazine. They have to, at this place they've got in Vermont, you know, called Von Trapp, the sound of music, they have to employ a bloke to play the piano who has to, for like 12 hours at a time, play Do, Re, Mi. Oh, a dear, a female.
Oh,
dear.
No. Imagine that driving you nuts.
No, whenever the tourists, the visitors come, all they apparently want to hear is Do, Re, Mi.
I mean, it's the simplest piece of music anybody's ever come up with because it explains the chords, doesn't it?
Yeah,
it's the notes within the chords, so that's all it is.
Yeah.
That's how she taught them how to sing.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
It is a wonderful film. My favourite bit of trivia from that film is, you know, the scene in the market in Salzburg where she's made all the kids lovely play clothes out of dead curtains.
Right.
You know that one? And they're all sort of tearing around the market.
Yeah.
And they come up to this orange stall. There's a guy selling oranges.
Right.
And she's passing the oranges from one kid to the next kid and they're passing them all down the road. Mm. And then the shot cuts to the orange seller.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a wooden box just beside him. And on the side of the box, it says, Made in Israel. And, of course, Israel didn't exist at the time this film is set in.
Absolutely. You're so right. Israel was formed in 1948. You're so right. Right. Well, talking about music and talking about chords and all that, I'm going to tell you something you may not know, Miss Jones, and that is that as we're recording today, it is the 77th birthday of Sir Tim Rice, one of your great friends.
Oh, yeah, well, I kind of did know that. It's in my diary.
Oh, right, OK. Have you sent him a card?
No, nobody sends cards anymore, do they, really?
I don't know, I do. I sent my, you know, my niece's birthday was 2 weeks ago. I sent her a couple of cards.
I think we do in the family, but most of us are wishing people a happy birthday on Facebook now, but of course you're not on Facebook, are you?
No, of course not, because, you know, I have to keep my face to myself for all of the time. And if you look at my face and examine it, you'll understand why. What I found amazing was, because I came across a piece saying to me, apparently Tim Rice was the inspiration for one of the greatest Lloyd Webber Tim Rice hits, Evita. He actually saw something about Eva Peron and went to Andrew Lloyd Webber, as he was then, before he was even Sir or Lord, and said, I think we can make a show out of this. I didn't realise it was Tim's inspiration and not Lloyd Webber's.
Oh, definitely, yes. He was obsessed with Eva Peron.
Really?
To the point that he named his daughter Eva.
Wow. I didn't know any of that. That's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, his daughter is a novelist. I'm very friendly with Tim. I've known Tim a long time.
Yeah.
And he's a very intelligent man. You know, if you think back to the very first musical that the pair of them wrote was Jesus Christ Superstar, inspired by a story in the Bible.
Jesus Christ Superstar, who in the world do you think you are?
You are on form today, Michael, I can tell you.
Thank you very much indeed. Listen, just talking about superstars and all that, I read a piece this morning, can't believe it. Chain-smoking Benedict got nicotine poisoning playing a cowboy. Benedict Cumberbatch developed nicotine poisoning 3 times while playing a chain-smoking cowboy. That is quite a dedication to your profession, isn't it? If you're prepared to literally, you know, threaten your own health.
Well, it's method acting, isn't it? So you've had this all down the years.
Yeah.
Renée Zellweger is good at this. She'll put on a vast amount of weight to play a part, as she did for Bridget Jones, for example.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the next film you see her in, can't remember the name of it, she's back down to being a skinny mini again.
Right.
Method acting has been around for a long time, I suppose to a point. Although if somebody said to you, you had to become a heroin addict to perform a part, wouldn't you draw the line?
I think you probably would. You're absolutely right. My dear mum, who I loved so much and sadly left us 2-3 years ago, the last film that my sister, because they lived in Bournemouth, my mum lived in a little house in Bournemouth with her, and Jill lived in her house, and the last film she took to see was the Irish guy, My Left Foot, Daniel Day-Lewis, played Abraham Lincoln, and I think it was called something like President or Lincoln.
I didn't see it.
I haven't seen it. Anyway, my mum unlike a lot of women, likes action films. You know, she liked a bit of, you know, action, Arnold Schwarzenegger and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Did she like a bit of...
Yeah, that's right. Oh, she loved all the Beatles. The Bond girls, Beatles.
That would have been a good film.
Well, at least the Beatles wrote, you know, one of the opening scores for a Bond film, which you think is the best ever.
Well, Macca did anyway, yes, Live and Let Die.
Yes, exactly. But anyway, so my sister took my mum to watch it. I think it was called Lincoln, actually. And it was so boring because it was all in very dark and it was Lincoln mumbling things about, you know, how he's going to start the American state and all this kind of stuff. And so afterwards, Jill, my sister, you know, was so disappointed that mum had found it so unentertaining. She had to take her out for a nice, you know, sort of early evening dinner afterwards and buy her a few glasses of sherry and all that kind of stuff. But then she looked it up and she found out that Daniel Day-Lewis, who played Lincoln, spent 3 months before the film even started shooting, mumbling and taking in the presence and the attitude and the lifestyle of Abraham Lincoln from reading hundreds of books about him.
And they get paid for that, you know. That research period when an actor is preparing for the role.
Really?
They are on full pay throughout that period.
Really? Yeah. God, it's amazing stuff, isn't it? Okay, folks, thank you very much indeed for being with us today. Myself, the Portmeister, and Ms. Leslie Ann Jones, who's on top form, by the way. The church warden, as I'm going to call her from now on, you know, who takes the occasional or three glasses of large gin and tonics.
You make me sound like the degenerate of the church wardens.
I wouldn't call it degenerate at all.
When have you ever found me on the floor of a bathroom?
Well, not often, but, you know, we were in...
Not ever, I don't think.
We were in different parts of the world for most of our lives. Miss Jones, we had a chat before we started today, and you told me you'd been talking to another legend of the rock business, Susie Quattro. What were you talking to Susie about?
Lovely Susie. Oh, she had her booster a couple of days ago, and she went to bed and woke up 18 hours later.
Golly. Right.
And felt very sort of, I mean, that's too much sleep in one hit, isn't it, really? I think your body goes into some sort of shutdown mode.
I think that's amazing. That's like being in a coma, isn't it?
Yeah, so she said she was going out for a long walk in the fresh air to liven everything up a bit.
Yeah, well, that's very contemporary because as I speak to you now, just 3 hours ago, I got my booster.
How'd it go?
My third jab. Absolutely brilliant. Absolutely brilliant, honestly. The first jab I had, I felt marvellous afterwards for about 2 or 3 days. I'm not joking. It was like somebody had, you know, given me not just a booster to ward off COVID, but a sort of energy. And then...
So for you, it was like drinking a bucket of Lucozade, was it?
Well, no. It was like drinking a couple of large, you know, G&Ts, to be honest. I felt really high. And then after the second one, I felt exactly the same. So I went in for the third one today. And I was warned that sometimes the third one, the booster jab, can be very different to your first two. I said, okay, fine, I'll have a look.
So what did they say might happen to you?
To start off with, which is quite interesting, when I had my first and second, I was into the surgery, jab in the arm and out again. It was like a production line. Today, it was into the, it wasn't a surgery actually, it was a community centre, you know. And after I'd had it, they said, right, now go to that area, please, and sit down. Do not leave for 15 minutes. So clearly there's some indication that there could be, you know, a response to this jab. And everybody was asked to sit down for 15 minutes. I sat down for 15 minutes. I felt great. I got up. I left. And I feel great now.
What happened to us the first two times.
Oh, really? Oh, no, it didn't happen.
Yeah, we had to wait 15 minutes both times.
Oh, right, okay. So, anyway, I came out and I took a picture of myself, what you call a selfie, with the background of all the, you know, all the people working in the...
You do good selfies, actually.
Yeah, well, thank you. That's very kind of you. You know, it's my Fleet Street training. Do you know what? You're absolutely right there. I worked with so many photographers over the years. I learned that a great photograph has to be what we used to call full heads. You've probably heard that expression, but it means get as close as you can and get as much of the person's face into the frame. You know what I mean?
Because, and also be very careful what's behind their head.
Exactly. You're so right, honestly, what you said.
You don't want the Crystal Palace Tower growing out of the top of your bonce or something.
You're absolutely right. And also remember that when people take their holiday pictures or any pictures, even these days, people who don't know what they're doing take selfies in nightclubs. If you're too far away, the focus of what you're trying to photograph is it's minuscule, it's miniature, and you've got to get in there and get it. So I did a selfie, not kind of self. I put that out. I put a caption on it saying that I felt very good. I'm very supportive of it. Please, if you thinking like me, go and get your third jab now. And I've had a kind of 70-30% reaction. 70% saying, well done, Mike. You have a public profile, very small public profile, obviously, but and well done. But 30% were, how dare you try and intimidate people into going to get a jab that will kill them and all this kind of stuff.
Oh, get a life. These people really irritate me. Yeah. I mean, don't have it if you want. Go and die in a corner if you'd like to.
Yes.
But, actually, this jab, like any vaccination, depends on the vast majority of the population having it, protecting not only themselves, but everybody else.
No, I totally agree. And all I was trying to say is, look, I'm sorry, that's my opinion. I think you should. I'm not, trying to bully anybody into going into it or doing it. Miss Jones, I want to talk to you about another woman who I've come across who I think is fantastic. And I sent you a note last night, so I was going to talk to you about Margaret, but I forgot to tell you her name is Margaret York. And she's a police officer from LAPD. And LAPD's magical, really, isn't it? You lived for a while quite a long while in Los Angeles. And we all know from, things like Columbo that LAPD means Los Angeles Police Department, And this woman, Margaret York, she entered the police literally as a secretary, and she rose to become like a top commissioner. And she broke the glass ceiling for women in the LAPD. And on the back of that, the great TV series Cagney and Lacey, which I loved, was based upon her. But sadly, she's died. And of course, I pick up a lot of these things from reading about people's lives. But I think she was a tremendous woman.
She was the police force's highest ranking woman.
Was she?
And of course, in those days, that was a huge leap to make, wasn't it?
Yes.
Nowadays, I mean, we have a chief of police in our own country.
Of course we did.
He's female. But so, it's not such an unusual thing anymore. But at the time, she was groundbreaking, really. They used to call her Peggy York, didn't they?
I didn't know
that. Sort of common name, yes.
Yeah.
But Cagney and Lacey was a very influential program during the 80s.
I thought it was brilliant because that was one of the first I can remember which sort of tried to mould together the work of a police officer with their home life and how it affected their home life. You know what I mean?
Yeah, very good point, actually. And because it featured females, I think.
Indeed.
I think, and it would be the case that it would affect a woman police officer's home life much more profoundly than
because
a man.
Because of childcare and all that kind of stuff.
Exactly, exactly.
And also in Cagney and Lacey, I don't know how much of it you watch, how many series, one of them turned out to be an alcoholic. A secret alcoholic. I mean,
Sharon Glazer?
Yeah, Sharon Glazer, I think it was, yeah. And
what was the name of the dark haired
one? Tyne Daly? Was it Tyne Daly?
Tyne Daly.
Yeah.
I tell you, I saw her in a play.
Right.
A few years ago now. She was playing the opera singer Maria Callas.
Oh, right. Okay.
In her later years.
Yeah.
And she was absolutely sensational.
Really?
What a great stage actress she was.
Yeah.
I wasn't prepared for how good it was going to be.
Really? I saw Tyne Daly. I'm a bit of a Columbo fanatic. And when Columbo became...
Oh, I love Columbo.
So do I. And when Columbo became really big, every actor stroke actress in the world wanted to be in Columbo, didn't they? And she was in that. And it was a fantastic plot about, she was a rich widow and a young boyfriend was going to try and kill her and all this going. It was just, but she, everything I've seen her in, utterly fantastic. Now, I want to talk...
Well, no, before you leave Columbo, I want to just throw in,
please.
You know, you probably, like me, you do these, from time to time, these chat shows and things like this, where they ask you about your journalistic technique. I do a lot of radios on this kind
of thing. Listen, Miss Jones, I'm sorry. I'm not sure that I'm ready to talk about my technique, you know.
Oh, come on. It's a family show. they ask, and I always talk to them about the Columbo technique.
Yeah.
Which is derived from the character in the TV show. So, you know, he always had this thing that he'd go along. He always knew who'd done it. Yeah. That was the premise of the show. You knew who the murderer was.
Absolutely.
And the whole point of the episode was him trying to prove
it. Yeah.
With the evidence, gathering everything. So he'd be very friendly towards these people. He would lull them into a sense of false security.
Yes.
And they would think they were off the hook.
No,
and then he'd go to the door to say goodbye and leave, and then he'd turn around very sweetly, yeah, and he'd say, just one thing. And that is how we get the best interviews in journalism, because
you
know, you do this great interview, but it's no headline coming out of it, but you've got a killer question tucked up your sleeve.
Oh.
And then you say, thank you very much, and off you go to leave. You get to the door and you turn around and you go, just one thing.
Mm.
Yeah. And then you lob the grenade of the killer question, and that's where you get your headline.
Honestly, Miss Jones, you are so right. What a skilled journalist you are. Do you know one of the most famous examples of where that worked was Glenn Hoddle got a phone call from a Times sports reporter on a Saturday morning, okay, asking about some general issue regarding the England football team. He was the England manager at the time. And the last question was related and somehow to Glenn Hoddle's beliefs, religious beliefs and Christianity and what he thought about health, to which Glenn Hoddle revealed he thought that people who abuse themselves in life often abuse themselves in death, and that he believed in people coming back. What's that called? I can't remember.
Reincarnation.
Reincarnation. That Glenn Hoddle believed in reincarnation, and that reincarnation was either positive or negative, rewarding or denying you within your life. It was so extraordinary that the Times reporter didn't bother even writing a sports story. He went to the news desk and said, this is extraordinary. This is the England manager talking about his beliefs in reincarnation. Glenn Hoddle lost his job about 10 days later. It was extraordinary.
Dear.
Extraordinary, wow. Honestly. But you're absolutely right.
Can you sack somebody for their beliefs these days?
Well, I think there's a general agreement he would stand down because, you know, he had a point and said, no, I stand by what I say. And they said, well, we can't quite accept it. And all this kind of, honestly, it was remarkable. I remember.
But is that a sackable offence today?
Well, golly, you know, the world in its values, which you and I have to observe because, you know, we've been around for a few decades. I certainly have as well. And sometimes it astonishes me about the way we have to change our, you know, our consideration of values. It's something I'll be perfectly honest, Leslie Ann, it's something I'm finding very hard to cope with, you know. And what I mean is that, you know, I go on to chat shows and I do television, all that kind of stuff. And sometimes when I've put forward a position on an argument, which I think is fairly reasonable, a few hours later, I reflect on it and think, I'm not sure that that's actually the right way to look at things in the modern world and modern life. I think I'm being serious here. I'm kind of struggling to catch up with the way that younger and middle-aged people think now and the way I think.
I think we're in this sort of quicksand at the moment where there's a panic on and everybody wants everything to change overnight. And of course, change can never be affected overnight. So there is a lot of uncertainty in the world at the moment.
Yes.
Suddenly, all the things that we have held dear and taken for granted all these years have been thrown into question and disarray.
Yes,
and we're none of us are sure what we're allowed to say, what we're allowed to think.
Yeah.
Can we express a view without offending everyone in the room?
Yeah.
Should we just keep it to ourselves?
Yeah.
And so this will settle down, because it always does when things suddenly take a corner, I suppose you call it.
Yeah.
Things have turned a corner. And we have to just be patient and wait for things to calm down, which they will.
Mm.
But at the moment, everyone's a bit hysterical about, you know, this is appropriate, that isn't, that's against the law.
Yeah.
You know, basically, we have to be careful of offending anyone else.
Yeah.
And we have to be mindful that not everybody shares our views. I suppose it's just that, really.
I totally agree. And, you know, at some stage, and I'm not joking here, we'll move on in a second, I might just decide to withdraw from public life, i.e. from, you know, broadcasting, journalism, radio and all that, because I'm not sure that I understand the way the world works anymore. And I certainly don't want to upset people, but I'm thinking to myself, well, maybe it would just be better to take a back step. That's for another day. I want to talk to you about a wonderful woman called Barbara Taylor Bradford, okay? And the reason is I saw a piece with her in a newspaper recently. She's being interviewed about lifestyle and all that. And Barbara Taylor Bradford, for our millions of listeners, started off as a typist at the Yorkshire Post in Leeds, where she comes from. And she rose through the ranks there to become a reporter. And then she moved to London, worked as a reporter there. And then she wrote a book. And she wrote a second book, didn't really get anywhere. She wrote a third book called A Woman of Substance, which became a worldwide hit. To this day, I think it sold about 40 million copies or so. No, I think it's 100 million copies, actually, I read. In this interview I read, in her latest book deal, she got paid $38 million for writing three books. She's incredibly successful. Now, quite early on in her career as a an author, authoress maybe, she moved to New York. And when I worked in New York in the 80s, we got an invitation. And when I say we, my colleague at the Daily Express Bureau in New York was Philip Finn, to go and see her and have a cocktail in her penthouse apartment on 66th Street. And we went there, and it's one of the few apartments in New York. She's got views on all four sides. She took us out on the balcony, threw her arm into the air, the view over Central Park, and said, "Okay, fellas, not bad for a lass from Yorkshire, is it?" And it was an incredible moment when I thought, golly. Anyway, she's done this interview. She's still going. Her husband sadly died 3 years ago, and they were married, I think, for something like 62 years. But the best of British, as far as I'm concerned, and, you know, a magnificent success story.
It really is. Interestingly, the Mail on Sunday reporter, Kate, who I sat next to at the commemorative service at St. Bride's, had been out to dinner with Barbara Taylor Bradford the night before.
No! What, in London?
Yeah, I think there might be a piece in the paper actually coming up this weekend.
Well, maybe she's here at the moment promoting her new book or something like that. That's maybe I think so.
And she said she'd had this extraordinary facelift.
Yeah.
That her face looked like glass. She must be in her 80s, Barbara Taylor.
Oh, yeah, she is, yeah, definitely.
But she said, you know, it was a very obviously a facelift, but a very, very good, expensive one. But still, I think it's a little bit dodgy because you're looking out of a face that isn't really yours.
Yeah. No, I kind of understand that. Your eyes are yours, aren't they, which you're looking out
of. It's about all that's left, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
I would never have a facelift, you know. I think there's only one excuse to have it, and that's if you've been, God forbid, in some terrible car accident or plane crash or something, and you're so disfigured that you need it to put your face back together again. But I think other than that, it's normal to age.
Mm.
And if your face is so lifted that it doesn't match the rest of your body, that's no good, is it?
I think you can do it incrementally. Kay Burley is a very successful broadcaster. She works on Sky News. And I think Kay's getting up towards 60. She might even be 60. She has admitted that incrementally she's had tucks and whatever you want to call that. I don't know if that's
nips and tucks, I think.
Yeah, nips and tucks or something like that. But she's quite open about it. And I think Kay looks magnificent. I saw her at a Christmas party, actually, the last time Christmas parties were going on. That must have been like 2 years ago or something like that. And I thought, golly, you know, you look fantastic. I don't blame anybody. The sort of people you're talking about and where facelifts started were to try and improve the lot of Spitfire pilots, Hurricane pilots, who got burnt badly in their planes before they were able to bail out over the English Channel, you know what I mean? And all that kind of stuff. And of course, remember Simon Weston? Simon Weston was so badly burnt.
Oh, he was in a terrible state, wasn't he?
I think he's had 120 operations or something like that, you know what I mean?
I'm too squeamish. There's no way.
Yeah.
I don't even like having an injection, you know?
Yeah.
People often say to me, how the hell did you have three babies, given how squeamish you are? Well, I had the first one and it nearly killed me.
Right.
The second two, I went privately. I said to the consultant, I want a general anaesthetic. She said, what? I said, yes, I'd like you to knock me out, wake me up when Vidal Sassoon arrives to do my hair, and I don't want to know anything about it in between. Right. And so I had general anaesthetic to have babies two and three.
Well, they
might not even be mine, you know.
Well, Miss Jones, you know, you are such a teaser.
Do we know who the mother is? Yeah.
Well, exactly. Well, I can give you some very good news because the last time you were pictured quite publicly was when you did the GB News interview and I was alongside you on Macca's new book, Lyrics.
Okay? Oh, yeah, yeah.
And you won't believe the amount of feedback I've had from people then, and of course the corniest statement in the world, "Ooh, Beauty and the Beast," you know, and all this kind of stuff.
Which was which?
Yeah. Well, exactly. That's exactly the one I threw back and said, "Don't talk about Leslie Ann like that." You know what I mean? But I'm not. You know, I don't necessarily want to puff up your ego, Miss Jones. So I know you haven't got an ego, but the number of people who said to me, "Golly, doesn't Leslie Ann look fantastic in that shot?" Because,
well, how very kind.
No, well, normally speaking, you wear dark glasses because it's part of your look, it's part of your image, all that kind of stuff. But on that particular night, the lighting was good and you're wearing, you know, kind of see-through glasses, for want of a better word. And I got an amazing feedback from people saying, "Hey, Porky, what a lucky man you are to work with Leslie Ann," all that kind of stuff, you know. So, well, so it was terrific. Listen,
I am the lucky one. I have to tell everybody that.
Well, you know, you make your own luck in life. Listen, I want to tell everybody before we go about the shocking experience I've had when my oven blew up, Miss
Jones. Goodness. Yes, I need to know about this.
Yeah. So there I am going through a normal working day, you know what I mean? You won't believe this. People mock me because I like fish fingers, okay? So I take out a packet of fish fingers, 10, and I put them
on. You were going to eat 10 fish fingers?
That's what I have for dinner sometimes, fish fingers with salt and lemon, nothing else, okay?
10 fish fingers?
Yes, it's what I call my fish finger pyramid.
Okay? It's what you call a double hander, get it?
Double hander, Miss Jones, you know, you're such a such a wag. So anyway, I tear my oven on. I put my fingers in, okay. And I'm very good at this sort of thing because I have a tray I put them on, but I always put, like, silver foil on the tray and then the fish fingers on that, you see what I mean? Means I don't have to clean the tray afterwards, you see what I mean? All this kind of stuff. So there I am. And it takes about 15 minutes normally for the fish fingers to be done. So there I am, and I've turned my back on it. I'm in my kitchen, and I've got a high stool which I can sit on to read the papers on the thing in the middle of the kitchen. And
the island, you mean?
The island. Thank you very much. And all of a sudden, I'm thinking, I can't smell my fish fingers. I know that sounds odd, but when you put something in the oven...
I say, officer.
Yeah. I know, it's a bit odd, isn't it? But normally you get some sort of aroma, don't you? If you've got a joint in the oven or something like that, you go, right, I thought, that's funny. So I go and open my oven door, because it opens outwards, if you see what I mean. It's not a pull-down. And it's a Canon, by the way. I know that because I've had it repaired. And my fish fingers are still rock solid hard, you know, and I thought, this is not good. So I slammed the door and I turned the heat off a bit, went round, sat on my stool again, and then boom, I mean literally bang, okay, all the lights in the apartment went out, just like that, you know.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, yeah.
So what, you just made it too hot? Is that what happened?
No, what had happened was that the filament was on its way out, okay. It wasn't strong enough to...
You keep your filament to yourself, if you don't mind.
Yes, you're right, yeah.
Family share.
Yes, it wasn't good enough to give any heat, but the fan was still on at the back of the oven. You know, it's one of those air fan type things, you know. And as soon as I turned it up and asked for more out of the filament rejected, bang, and then it short-circuited the whole apartment. And... you know, there was like a flash of light and a flash of...
Oh, God, you were lucky. I was sitting right there.
I was very lucky not to be touching the oven at the time. Anyway, look, I can't thank the guy that I called up the next morning and said, can you fix it within 15...
You said what to him?
No, I said, can you come and fix my oven? You
know, sorry. Yeah, translation, stuff. Yeah.
I thought I might need a new oven, you know. And he said, no, we'll sort this out for you, don't worry. 6 months ago, he came to the same apartment because I live in more than one apartment. But the one that this happened in is the oldest apartment I've got, where I've got newer equipment in the other two places I live. And 6 months ago, he came and exactly the same guy fixed my washing machine where the filament had also blown out in that. So the lesson here is that if you've had the same kind of stuff for, you know, more than 10 years, beware, because it might just start blowing out on you, you know. And
So are we talking a filament or an element?
An element. I think an element. I think
it's elementary, my dear Watson.
Elementary, my dear Watson. It certainly is. I think it is an element, and I think you're absolutely right. But there you go. That's just domestic life. I've worked out, Leslie Ann, the time of life I'm in now, that life, actually, when you get up every morning, is just one problem after the other. And when you've solved that problem, oh, I've got a problem with my publisher. Oh, I've got it sorted. Right, now that I've got a clear day now. Oh, no, I haven't. The oven's just blown up, OK? And then, no, I'm OK now. No, I haven't. The binmen haven't arrived. My bins haven't been cleared, you know. What's it? Oh, I've got a note here from somebody saying you sent your invoices in, but you haven't put the right information on them. It's just one problem after another.
I couldn't agree more. Because I'm writing a book at the moment, as you know, I get into this groove of my day is, it's a writing day most days.
Yeah.
And I just need to get up, get myself together and get on with it.
Sure.
But along come all these issues that you have to deal with.
Absolutely.
And then before you know it, it's lunchtime.
Exactly.
Before you've even had a chance to actually start the work. So it is, we need secretaries or wives or something,
we do.
Don't we?
Yeah.
I could do with a wife. Just somebody to do all this stuff.
I totally agree. My mate Alan Brazil, who's the best in the world, okay? I mean, honestly, he's driving me mad. Come on, Porky, we're going out for a few beers. I can't, Al. Why? I've got to go and see my accountant. What do you mean you go see accountant? I said, Al, it's that time of the year, you know, invoice taxes. No, bollocks to that, son. Get your wife to do it. That's what I do.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not joking.
We missed out there, didn't we, somewhere along the line?
Yeah. Everything that happened in Al's life was dealt with by his wife, Jill, a wonderful woman, or, you know, a member of his team that Jill employed. You know what I mean?
We've made a very big mistake along the line here.
Yeah.
Virtually all the men we know of our age have all got women running their lives and they're just having a good time.
I think you're right. There we go. Right. That's it for today, folks. Miss Jones, thank you very much indeed for having joined me today.
Mr. Parry.
We can now reveal to our millions of listeners that this is take two. Because one of the other problems that I've just outlined was that my Wi-Fi blew up on take one. So it's just...
It wasn't your wife, it was your Wi-Fi.
It was, exactly. I need a Wi-Fi that works. There we are. Right, OK, folks, thank you very much indeed. We'll be back with you again next week. Miss Jones, thank you for your time as well. And to everybody else, have a great weekend.
Face is a stone. It doesn't budge. She did sing the hymns, but she doesn't open her mouth very wide.
Yeah.
And I suppose all of that is to do with not being caught by a photographer in an ungainly sort of facial expression or something.
Maybe. She likes a gin and tonic or two, though, doesn't she? We know
I
that.
Guess she does, but she didn't give much away.
Okay.
But she was very well behaved, as you'd expect. Mm. So I got away with it.
Mm. Okay, that's excellent. But then you see, so there you are, church warden, St. Bride's and all that, you know, paramount of virtue, paragon of virtue, I should say.
paramount of virtue.
Yeah, paramount, yeah, well, paramount's a film company, I think, isn't it? Mm. Paragon of virtue. And then within half an hour, you're getting down with the rock and roll set at Joe Allen. You know, I mean, how do you marry these two sides of your life together, Miss Jones?
Well, aren't they all part of being human?
Don't know.
There's no rule that says that a member of the clergy can't have a good stiff drink, you know.
Yeah, a stiff drink.
There's no rule.
Family show here,
Miss Jones. So are we talking a filament or an element?
An element. I think an element. I think
it's elementary, my dear Watson.
Elementary, my dear Watson. It certainly is. I think it is an element. No, I think you're absolutely right. But there you go. That's just domestic life. Don't you know what I mean? She was only 17. Now, again...
It wasn't quite like that, was it?